This is KSQD Santa Cruz, K-Squid 90.7 FM and online at ksqd.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro and I'm happy to be bringing my long-running radio program From the Bookshelf to KSQD. I hope you enjoy my conversations with best-selling authors of fiction and nonfiction, graphic novelists, actors, photographers, and singer-songwriters discussing their work. This week, my guest is Deborah Holt Larkin. She's the author of the gripping true crime story, A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan, and The Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. The incredible story of a 1958 murder that ended with the last woman ever to be executed in California. Then later on, From the Bookshelf contributor Eve Golden drops by to discuss the year in obituaries. I'm so glad you're joining me for From the Bookshelf.
Deborah Holt Larkin is my guest. Her new book, A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers, is one of the most unusual true crime books I've ever read because it's also a coming-of-age memoir, it's a family story, and a noir thriller all rolled up in one. Deborah Holt Larkin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So let me see if I get this straight. Your grade school teacher would not let you talk about this murder in class. So 60 years later, you wrote a book about it.
Exactly. Yes. She didn't want me to say anything about it. I thought it was big news for sharing time, but she didn't.
Well, you do a really wonderful job of capturing that era in school. I was a school kid then too. Right. And what it was like to be in school. And that's a place where you ended up making your life. You were an educator for a long time.
I did.
So thank you for recreating that classroom feeling. It was a lot different, I think, than it is now.
I enjoyed writing those chapters about the school because spending all those years on an elementary school campus, I hear those children's voices, you know, still.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering, how was she able to? Where she hear? Did she keep really good notes? Did she keep a diary when she was 11? But I don't know, you just have a good ear for recreating it.
Yes, it was those scenes were recreated. I mean, I remembered the part about not trying to share the information and being told no and coming at it from another angle. So yeah, I had to recreate the scenes.
Well, before we talk more about your book, let me ask you a little bit about education and schooling. You know, I think that time in school that we were just mentioning in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the teachers and the atmosphere at school was a lot more, it was a lot less forgiving, I guess I would say. It was a lot more, they were very strict and they were very, of course, they only taught, you know, in one way. And if you could learn that way, right, you were good. And if you couldn't, you know, you were screwed.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like I was a terrible student. I was like an F student all the way through elementary school. But even given that, you know, at the end of elementary school, I knew all kinds of stuff, even though I didn't intentionally learn any of it. You know, like I knew Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 and the independence of the Santa Maria in 1776 and all that stuff that today, you know, high school graduates don't know.
Right.
Why, what is your theory about that? Why do you think that even though we are so much better at teaching, students are so much, so much poorer at learning?
Well, I think it's the, I mean, this is just my take on it. I've been retired and for about 15 years, so I'm not really, I don't really know what's going on right now, but a lot less emphasis was placed on, reasoning skills, and the curriculum kept getting expanded and expanded and expanded because there were lots of different voices of people who wanted certain things to be taught. And the facts, like you're talking about, like that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1490, that was just gone. That wasn't considered really important. It was mentioned, but various rote kinds of learning of facts was just not emphasized at all. It was more learning about, you know, maybe And I think, and also things were not really studied in depth. Columbus might have got a mention, but there were so many things to learn about and talk about in social studies that there was really not much time spent. And plus, he became, there was controversy about his trip to the United States, and so I don't know. There were a lot of things that were not really in the curriculum that were in the curriculum back in the 1950s.
Yeah. Now, your specialty was children who struggled with
special needs.
Special needs. Mm-hmm. And was that inspired by your mother?
I think yes, somewhat. And my experiences. I mentioned the first experience of meeting a little girl who was institutionalized at Cameron State Hospital, where my mother worked, for severe emotional disturbance. But then later on, that happened after the book was finished. When I was in college, I worked for 2 summers at the hospital in the adolescent treatment school there. And that's when I, really became interested in working with students with special needs. But then later in my career, the last 15 years, I was the principal of the elementary school. So I was, interested in the needs of all of the students at that point.
Were you a good principal?
I think I was.
Yeah,
I'm still, well, I had my moments there. I'm still friends with a lot of the students, and we had a book launch up in Julian where I was principal and where I taught, and it was a huge turnout. And there was a lot of parents who came and a lot of teachers who came. So, yeah, I think all in all, it was.
I think that would be a very difficult job, the principal. Right. I avoided that at all costs.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked being able to make a bigger difference. I liked being able to make a difference when I was in the classroom to students, individual students, but I liked being able to make a difference for teachers and the resources they had and things that were available for students to learn. So it was.
Were you principal at the same school for the whole time that you were principal?
Well, yes, because Julian, California is a very small town. They just have 1 elementary school, 1 junior high, and 1 high school. Well, there is a little bit, another school district has a little smaller school and a couple miles away. But yes, I was there. I taught briefly in Nebraska, my first job. That's a long story. Happened to be there. Actually, living in Nebraska, taught in Iowa, and then a private school when I first came back to California. But otherwise, I was at Julian the whole time. It was a great, great little town and a wonderful school to work in.
Tell us a little bit about your father, because I know he is one of the fuses that lit this book.
Yeah. He was... I've heard him described many times as he was an original. You just don't find people with his personality really quite like that. At least I haven't run across anybody. He was somebody who was very, very ethical, very kind towards people. And he was interested in everything and everybody, but kind of at a distance. He was not a man who had a lot of close friends. He had colleagues, and then he was very involved in our family.
And what's his connection to the story that you write about in A Lovely Girl, the tragedy of Olga Duncan and the trial of one of California's most notorious killers?
Well, Olga disappeared from her apartment in Santa Barbara. And her body wasn't discovered until a month later. And where the kidnappers and murderers had taken her was from Santa Barbara across the county line into Ventura, California, just 6 miles in approximately. And so the whole trial, this huge sensational trial that reporters from all over the country came to, happened in my hometown, and my father, who worked for the Ventura County Star Free Press, was assigned to be the lead reporter on that. So he covered it, really, he had begun to cover it from when it was, just a disappearance, but it was going on up in Santa Barbara. And then once he got into the story, and the trial started, he became absolutely fascinated with that case. And really more the people involved, Mrs. Duncan, Frank, especially Mrs. Duncan's, who I refer to as her sidekick, Emma Short, who was 80 years old at the time and who was with Mrs. Duncan on her shopping trips in Santa Barbara, where she was trying to find somebody to get rid of her daughter-in-law, Olga. So, and he really became kind of a local expert on that. He covered it, you know, through the disappearance, the investigation, the trial, the executions. And he talked about it a lot. He talked about it to me a lot as an adult. And he wanted to write a book on it himself. He died quite soon after he retired and never was able to do that. So I began to think that I would like to write a book about it.
And he wrote, he was not necessarily a crime reporter. He wrote about all kinds of things.
Right. Ventura was, I think, around 20, the town of Ventura was maybe 20,000, between 20 and 30,000 population at this time. But the paper served the entire county. And, but it still was a kind of a small town newspaper. So yeah, he was assigned politics and crime. And human interest. He wrote a column too. He wrote a weekly column that, you know, covered all kinds of things, including what was going on in our family. It was kind of a humorous column. And people have asked me, well, you know, why did you do this, you know, kind of alternating chapters between the family and the and what was going on with the crime? And I said, well, that was the way I lived it. You know, there was two things going on in our home, our family life and my father's constant discussion about the case. He had no filter. So he was talking about things that probably parents today really wouldn't want. They wouldn't think that a parent should talk about in front of their child. And then I read the paper as his 10-year-old. I read about the crime, and in the very next section would be his column. And so that's how I sort of lived it. And that's how I remembered that time in my life.
Well, Deborah Holt Larkin, when you were writing the book, did you have all of his columns and writings about the trial to read and refer to?
I had a lot of his columns. I said this before. He kept this big trash bag, big black trash bag in the corner of his home office. And he used to tear out his columns and toss them into the bag. So by the time he passed away, there was this huge amount of
what columns. What a great filing system.
Hundreds, yeah, hundreds of them. And so I asked my mother if I could have them, and she gave me those. So I had a lot of his columns. And as far, I had some of his clippings from the Duncan case, but I spent a lot of time at the Ventura Library on the microfiche machine, going back through and copying off a lot of the articles, and at the Santa Barbara News Press and their library in Santa Barbara, their articles, the LA Times. I was at the library down in LA for a long time. So got a lot of the newspaper articles from the library microfiche machine.
Well, now you write also, as we were saying, this is also a story about your family and what went on in your home. Right. And at the same time, one of the things that annoys little Debbie in the story is that her father writes about her, right, his column. So my brother and sister and I have very differing perspectives on our childhood. But your sister is still alive and well.
Yes, Betsy's still alive.
Yeah. And how did she feel? So you didn't like being written about in your column, but how did your sister feel about being written about in your book?
I let her read everything about, you know, so but she could see before, so she could veto anything that she thought was not right or inappropriate. But no, she's enjoyed it. And we even used to talk while I was writing. You know, because I wanted to see her take on how she remembered something and get a little input. And we would laugh and laugh over the phone, talking about things that didn't even make it into the book, but, you know, were kind of crazy. And Betsy, she was, you know, enough younger than me that she says she doesn't really remember that time in our life when the Duncan trial was going on, and she doesn't remember our father talking about it. But and I don't really think she read the columns like I did. So she was a little bit unaware of those. She's not a big paper reader, newspaper reader.
Did she veto anything that you were intending to put in your story?
No, she went in the chapter where we were shopping in Ventura. It wasn't with her. I was with my friend Marilyn. She said, no, that's the wrong block. She still lives in Ventura. Oh. This store was in that. So she more corrected me on just things about Ventura than hers. And then after the book was written, and published, and I was going to be doing a little get together in Ventura, kind of a book launch party up in Ojai. I said, well, I'm going to read, I think I'll read the part about the Thanksgiving dinner. Okay. And she said, okay, well, just find something where I'm not crying all the time. And I said, oh, and I hadn't really thought of that before. I guess there's a lot of scenes where she's crying and she really wasn't that big of a crier. So,
but she wanted pancakes and they didn't have pancakes.
Yeah, I know.
No, it's very charming. And it's very interesting because, you know, normally true crime, I don't really read a lot of true crime stuff because it's usually lurid and padded and there's a lot of violence that I'm not particularly interested in things that happened a long time ago to people I don't care about. But in the case of your book, although there is a satisfying, you know, police procedural true crime story, it's also funny. There's a tremendous amount of humor and warmth in the story.
Yeah, well, thank you. I tried for that, and I also saw parts of the crime chapters as sort of dark comedy with Mrs. Duncan and her friend and the bumbling killers and some of the things the witnesses said. And when I was writing the book, sometimes people would say, well, okay, what is the story? And I so occasionally say, well, it's Ann Rule meets Dave Barry in Fargo.
Yes. Very accurate. Good.
Yeah, I think I had one other place in there. I forget. But I see it a little bit as because these, like in Fargo, these hired killers were such, you know, bumblers.
Yes. So let me ask you a couple of questions about the case and about your take on it. So, I mean, one of the issues that's raised in your book is the death penalty.
Yes.
And I wonder how do you stand on the death penalty today?
Well, I can't say I'm opposed to the death penalty totally because there's just a few people that I think, you know, maybe that would be deserved. I read an article the other day about, I think his name is Charles N.G. Nung, and he and his partner up in Northern California, they kidnapped and murdered mostly women. They had a torture chamber. And they filmed themselves doing all sorts of things. Yet their case continues to be appealed through the system. And I thought, you know, if they're going to have a death penalty, that's somebody who deserves it. But like I said at the end of the book, I'm not sure the death penalty makes us any safer. So I guess I'm still ambivalent about it.
There's a conversation that you have with your father in the book in which your father says, you know, if people could see an execution, then they probably would be opposed to the death penalty. And little Deborah says, well, then they should also see the pictures of the victim and her unborn child.
Yeah, I know. And that's there's another part in the book, a few chapters before the end, where he's come home from, my dad's come home from the, after the death sentence was pronounced at the end of a penalty trial. And I think I asked a type of question about if he doesn't think that she should be executed. And he said, you know, it was only less than 10 years after, maybe 10 years or more after World War II had ended. And he said, well, you know, if we can send our young men to defend our, to die, to defend our country, maybe we can execute a few of our killers to make our country safer, something like that. But after he went to the and saw the executions, he changed very much. He was just opposed to the death penalty.
Interesting. And of course, the governor was opposed to the death penalty. The governor who was governor when the death penalties were issued.
He still signed off on her.
And Carol Chessman as well.
Right. I think the governor, Pat Brown, was just elected a few years before she was executed, but or before the trial started, I think somewhere around 1958. And the governor, when Carl Chessman, well, no, I guess I'm wrong, because Carl Chessman was executed finally in the 60s. Right. He was the governor then also. Yeah.
His Chessman figures into your story as well.
Right. Yes.
You were a strange kid, is what you're telling
me. I was. Well, I heard about Chessman. What got me a little bit interested in, we used to have slumber parties in my friend's patio room, and we would have the radio on late at night. And of course, we were listening to, you know, rock and roll music, but the news cast was something about Carl Chessman and one of his appeals, because he was on death row for a long time. Yeah. And I was interested in that afterwards.
Yeah. Your book tells the story of a terrible crime. And I wonder, is there any doubt in your mind that the defendants were guilty?
Absolutely none. They just, well, first of all, without divulging too much, one of the killers confessed and led the police to this isolated area on this road to show them where they had buried the body. And he confessed to what happened. And then his partner in crime finally decided to confess to save his soul. He was worried about going to hell. And so a few days later, he confessed. And by the way, I don't think either of those confessions would have taken place today, because of it was pre-Miranda warning and pre-right to have a lawyer during your questioning. And also, the second guy confessed to a minister, and I don't believe that is allowed today. And then he passed on to the police. But anyway, they confessed, they showed it, and they never wavered. They never tried to say, oh, we really didn't do it. And then Mrs. Duncan just left such a trail all over Santa Barbara that she was looking for somebody to kill Olga. And then the man she hired testified against her, and the woman who set it up testified against her. And then her 80-year-old friend, Mrs. Short, who was with her during all of these times, because she tried to hire about five or six different people before she found the two that agreed to do it. She testified. So, and then she made up this kind of cockamamie story about why she was paying them off.
Don't you think it's odd? And I know you do, because you mentioned it in your book, but none of these people who were approached ever went to the police and said, oh, this woman wants me to kill her daughter-in-law.
Yes. And I think it was because, this is what my dad said to me later in life, when we would still talk about the case before he passed away, that she approached people who were not really the most upstanding citizens and were not really interested in getting involved with the police. Some of them were her son Frank's clients. He was a criminal defense attorney himself in Santa Barbara. And some of were his clients or family members of his clients. So they weren't interested really in running off to the police. And then Mrs. Short, the sidekick, said that she was afraid of Mrs. Duncan, that she would afraid what would happen to her if she were to tell the police.
And her son, I mean, I don't know It's just a bizarre relationship.
Yeah.
A bizarre relationship. I mean, I think I would be pretty angry at my mother if she murdered my wife.
Right. I've come to Frank Duncan doesn't grant any interviews. So we don't know what he was thinking at the time.
Did you try when you were writing to call?
Yes, I did call. He had his law office. Even at this advanced age, he had his law office up in L.A. And I called and he picked up. I was kind of surprised. And I didn't get very many words out of his mouth before he said, no, I don't ever discuss this. That's all in the past, and hung up. But just as an aside, there's somebody I know who's a judge in L.A. County who's had him appear in his court even as maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and when he's in his early 90s, late 80s, and he said that, you know, he's sharp as a tack and still practicing law. They were just arraignment hearings that he was doing a whole trial for anybody. But anyway, I believe that Frank Duncan wanted to save his mother from the gas chamber. And that was a big part of his motivation. Plus, he saw himself, I believe, as kind of as a defense attorney. He didn't think that DAs and police played fair with his clients. And he was always, his notion was him against them. And that, I think that was part of his motivation. Plus, I think that he loved his mother. I think that she was a woman who, I mean, she thought the world of Frank. She thought Frank was the greatest kid that ever lived. And, you know, children respond to that, no matter how crazy or bad the parent is. When your mom just thinks that you are just completely wonderful and you can do no wrong, you know, I think there was a bond there between them. So I think he was trying to save her from the gas chamber.
She had other children as well.
Yes, she did. She had three from her very first marriage when she was very, very young. And when she left her husband, she left the kids. Mm-hmm. And then she went on and married multiple men. And then she had Frank by one of her next husbands. And then she married a man named Frank, was named Frank Lowe after his birth father. And then she married Frank Duncan when she got to Santa Barbara, and she just changed Frank's name, last name, to Duncan. And then she had another child with Frank Duncan Sr., a girl who died in a roller skating accident when she was 14. And then she made up another child, because one of the things she did was she would marry men and then try to bilk them out of money. And so she married one of Frank's fellow law students who was in his early 20s when she was in her late 40s. And then she I won't go into this scheme that she would promise them money if they married her, but she invented a child. She pretended that she had a child by that marriage when he was off in the military service someplace, and demanded child support as well as alimony.
She was a...
And so that was the phantom sixth child.
She was a criminal in so many ways.
She was a con artist before she hired these guys to murder her daughter-in-law.
But yet she wasn't particularly good at it.
Not the murdering the daughter, but she was kind of efficient. One of the things that they would do in Santa Barbara, I think before she married Mr. Duncan, was that she would talk to a landlord, give them this sob story, and tell them how the money was coming. She would make up some story about her husband was in the military and the money was going to be coming. She would move into the apartment or house, and then she would just live there until it would take them months to kick her out. And she would try to bilk the money men that she married. She would always try to bilk them out of money, apply for alimony. Never live with them.
This is KSQD Santa Cruz. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Holt Larkin, and her book is called A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. Later on, From the Bookshelf contributor Eve Golden will be here to discuss the year in obituary, so stay tuned.
Deborah Holt Larkin, your book is a true crime story, but at the same time, it has an element of fiction in that, you know, you write it like a novel in that you tell us words and actions and thoughts in ways that couldn't be preserved in court transcripts.
Right.
And how did you decide to do that? And is that, I don't know, is that okay in the world of true crime?
Yes, it's okay in the world of writing nonfiction. It's called either narrative nonfiction or creative nonfiction. And I say in the notes to readers at the beginning that these are going to, some of this is going to be recreated scenes. And I do kind of a little explanation of this in the note to readers. But I started out, I wanted to become a writer. I went off to college in the 60s, and like a lot of women, I ended up getting a teaching credential instead of becoming a writer. But I sort of held on to that dream. And so when my youngest son went away to college, I immediately enrolled in a creative writing program at UC San Diego in their extension program. And I thought that I wanted to write mysteries, fiction. And I was planning to somehow weave this plot into this mystery book that I wrote. But, you know, it was just stranger than fiction and really just so wild that I didn't think that maybe an editor would think this was believable enough to be a fiction book. So having started it that way, when I began writing a nonfiction, I wanted to make it read more like a novel. And I knew about the creative nonfiction, narrative nonfiction. And so that's how I wrote it. And it's interesting because there was a grand jury hearing that had most of the witnesses testifying. And so I used some of their testimony in dialogue for the crime part, so that the dialogue was real. And then in the newspapers, they gave a lot, the newspaper articles about the trial were a lot different than they might be today. They described every witness, what they were wearing, you know. So when I say a witness is dressed in, you know, with a velveteen collar and all of this, it's because that's what was reported in the newspaper. So mm-hmm. I really had kind of a good picture of the courtroom. And plus there were all these photographs that were taken in the courtroom. So I could visualize that to write it. And and then I had the transcripts. And so the newspaper articles filled in all the details that were not in the transcripts. And I had newspaper articles from four different newspapers that I was relying on. And I just wanted, and when I read those transcripts, their testimony was really riveting. And I wanted the readers to kind of feel like I did, like you're right there in the courtroom. So that's why I chose narrative nonfiction.
And you do it very effectively, so effectively that I'm sure that now you will write a novel. I mean, now you've got a book, got a book in print, and it's a good book, and it's a solid work of art. And so, and now you know how to write. You know, you're writing, right. So you're all warmed up. So you're halfway through your novel. Am I right?
No. I wish I thought I would be starting right away, but it seems like that there's a lot to do after the book comes out, as far as promoting the book. So. Maybe in a couple of months, I have an idea. I have a thought. I have characters and a plot in mind, but I haven't really started writing it yet. So that would be my next intention, is to write a novel.
Yeah, well, I hope when that happens that you'll come and talk to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Be happy to.
Let me mention again, this book is called A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. Let me ask you one more question before I let you go.
Sure.
You mentioned the Miranda rights issue. Mm-hmm. This would have been a very different case. And probably, like you said, none of the evidence would have been admissible, in which case they probably would not have been found guilty.
Right. Well, I don't believe they would have ever found Olga's body. So I think, and I don't believe that the killers would have talked if they'd had an attorney advising them to just remain silent. So I don't know that I think they would always have suspected that Mrs. Duncan was involved, but I don't know that it would have been they would have been able to approve it in court. And so that's kind of, I think, well, I think Miranda rights are a very good thing, and I think that we need them. And so, but I also believe that this case was, there's no doubt in my mind that these were the killers, and this was the plot that ended Olga's life. So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of.
It's almost a full circle to my opening question, where we were talking about school and how, although schools are better now, students don't learn as much.
Well, they don't learn facts and details and other kinds of things as well as much.
Yeah. And so although the Miranda rights are good and they protect people.
Yes.
There's a negative side to it as well.
Well, I guess, because maybe they could have found another way to solve Olga's crime or Olga's murder. There was a man who who thought he saw something. They asked the public in the newspaper, the police did, if they saw anything suspicious the night that Olga disappeared. And there was a man who reported seeing a car parked along Casitas Pass Road with two men that were getting out of the car. But he couldn't remember where. I mean, that's a very curvy road. He couldn't remember. Maybe eventually they could have found the body. I don't know. It would have been more difficult.
Well, we've been talking about this book a lot, but we really haven't even scratched the surface. There's so many wonderful things in it. I just want to mention how much I love the scene when you're riding on the freeway with your father. That's one of the greatest things I've ever read. It was really great.
I'm sure my
listeners would love it.
And somebody asked me about that, and you didn't ask me how long it took me to write the book, but it was off and on for 9 years.
Wow.
I decided that was going to be the ending scene very early in my writing. And I would keep a folder, and then I would jot down ideas or remembrances of what I wanted to put in there. When I was doing the research, if I saw anything of the building of the freeway, I immediately copied that also. But yeah, I knew that's how I wanted to end that book.
And it really happened.
Yes, it did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful book. A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. And even though it's a true crime and sad crime story, it is also an uplifting and absolutely entertaining work of art. And the author is Deborah Holt Larkin, my guest today. Thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Gary.
Deborah Holt Larkin. Her book is called A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers. This is KSQD. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
From the Bookshelf, contributor Eve Golden joins us now. Eve Golden is an historian of American popular culture in the 20th century. She's written several books, including the instant classic Jane Mansfield, The Girl Couldn't Help It. She's written biographies of Jean Harlow and Theda Bara and John Gilbert, and her forthcoming book, Strictly Dynamite, The Sensational Life of Lupe Velez. In addition, Eve Golden writes obituaries for a national news service. Eve Golden, welcome back to the show.
Hello, it's nice to be back.
Well, so I thought since we were at the close of the year, it might be a nice time to look back on those that we've lost in 2022. There were some major deaths even recently.
There really were. There's always a big one at the very end of the year, just after everyone has closed their year-end issues. Inevitably. It's like last year it was Betty White, and before that it was Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. Somebody always kicks off just when it's too late to get them in the year-end issues. So we'll see who dies in the next 2 weeks. Well, but to me, the actress who upset me the most was Susan Tolsky, who probably a lot of people have never heard of. She played Biddy, the comedy relief bride on Here Come the Brides in the late 60s.
Yeah,
was brilliant. She stole every scene she was in, even from Joan Blondell.
Joan Blondell was
in. Her co-star, Robert Brown, who was gorgeous, also died this year. But Susan Tolsky was one of the ones who upset me, because I was watching reruns of that show on one of those old people TV stations where Joe Namath tries to sell you Medicare. And Susan Tolsky was just brilliant, wonderful actress.
Well, I felt a similar pang when I heard that James Gardner's sidekick, Stuart Margolin, had passed away.
He was in everything and always good.
Yeah, I loved him, of course, on Rockford Files, but also he was on, he did a lot of things with James Gardner. He was on Brett Maverick and other shows that James Gardner did. I think James Gardner was his angel.
Must have been. And a lot of comedians this year.
Right. In fact, Judy Tenuta was on this show from the bookshelf.
I loved her. What was she like to talk to? Because she was one of my favorites.
Well, she stayed in character all the time that we talked and was playing the accordion. I mean, she actually had her accordion with her when we were chatting.
She's one of the few comics I have on my iPod.
She was great. But there were some other comics.
Well, Bob Saget apparently was beaten to death by a padded headboard in a hotel room.
Did they ever solve that mystery, Eagle?
That is so bizarre. Every time a comedian died this year, I looked to see if Bob Saget's headboard was somehow involved. Like there was a padded headboard traveling the country, murdering comedians all year.
Right, because there was Gilbert Gottfried.
And Louis Anderson, Gallagher, right. Freddie Roman. I mean, just a lot of, there's always, I've noticed, there's never a year where there's more deaths or more famous deaths, but there's always a group of people. Like one year it's all musicians, one year it's all old Hollywood people. This year it was all comedians.
Mm. Well, of course, there were some losses in the music field. And I think one of the things that happens is that we take people for granted. And then after they're gone, we think, oh, my God.
Well, Naomi Judd was very sad because I hadn't been following her problems. So that was a surprise.
Yeah. Now, what were her problems? She had health problems.
Depression.
Oh.
And she shot herself upstairs where her daughter could find her, which I think is impolite. I mean, at least take a hotel room or something, you know? You don't want your daughter to find you.
Yeah, I don't know what you're thinking of when that moment occurs, thankfully.
But there was somebody just recently, Stephen Boss, shot himself in a hotel room, and his wife released the really unfortunately phrased tribute that he brightened up every room he entered. And I'm thinking, well, the hotel maid may have something different to say about that.
Eve. And of course, Twitch also went to a hotel room, right?
Yeah. And Queen Elizabeth II did not. But
no,
her death was not a surprise, obviously, but just it's so weird not having her here anymore because it's like the pyramids are suddenly gone.
Yeah, this will be the first Christmas in 75 years that she's not going to do her Christmas thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, now we've got King Charles, and I'm sure he'll be a very good king. But not having Queen Elizabeth is just, I have a lot of British friends, and they're kind of in shock about it, because even though they knew it was coming, she'd just always been there.
My wife says that she can't get over the fact that he's King Charles and not a King Charles Spaniel.
I wonder if... Well, I seriously doubt people kid him about that. He's probably heard it a lot. And Anne Heche, what the hell, Anne Heche?
What happened to her? I mean, she was.
She'd always had issues. And that was just, I mean, she did something horrible, but she paid in the worst possible way. I mean, that was just awful.
Yeah, horrible. I was really moved by a couple of musicians who left us, including Christine McVie. I always liked her. I'd seen Fleetwood Mac in concert several times, and she is so great. And when you look at the Fleetwood Mac Greatest Hits album, she's written more than half of the songs on there. So many of their great songs. I really felt that one. And Olivia Newton-John, who was also a guest here on my show once, not too long ago.
Well, her, we knew she had been ill for a long time.
Yeah, she had cancer.
And Loretta Lynn, too, had not been in good health. And Jerry Lee Lewis, I'm amazed he made it as long as he did.
Yeah, a lot of people were like, Jerry Lee Lewis is still alive?
Yeah. And of course, the old timers, Sidney Poitier, Angela Lansbury, Robert Morse, I loved him. I saw him in the touring company of How to Succeed in Business when I was a kid. That was the first live show I saw in Philadelphia.
Wow. Yeah, neat.
Oh, I love Rudy Valley.
And he had a great, I don't know if you say third act, but final act in Mad Men.
It was nice how they cast him as basically the elderly version of the character he played in that show.
Yeah, yeah. And they actually gave him a musical number for his final episode.
That was sweet. And another one of my girlhood crushes, David Burney, from the last version of Abie's Irish Rose, Bridget Loves Burney.
Right. Bridget Loves Burney.
Which was, it was a terrible show, but the cast was charming.
I love how they had
the black guy, because it was the early 70s, so they had to have a black friend, and he would just show up and be black for a couple of minutes and then leave.
Well, diversity was making its headway.
It's like, and we got a Jew and an Irish person here. Let's bring in a black guy.
You mentioned Angela Lansbury there in passing. I saw her on Broadway three different times. I saw her in MAME in 1966.
Wow.
And then I saw her in Sweeney Todd in 1980. Wow. And then just a few years ago, I saw her in Blithe Spirit.
Huh.
So three completely, not only different decades, but two different centuries I saw her.
Loved her in, what was that first movie? Gaslight. And I recently saw the original British version of Gaslight, which I think is kind of almost better than the Hollywood version.
Yes, I've seen it too. It's good.
Because Anton Walbrook was scarier than Charles Boyer.
Yeah, yeah. Both versions are great. And Angela Lansbury, of course, I think she's great in The Manchurian Candidate. That's one of her most chilling.
That is one of the movies that just unintentionally makes me laugh. When that girl comes in dressed as a playing card, I fall off the sofa in hysteria.
That's a chilling moment, Eve.
It's chilling, like Karen Black being chased around in Trilogy of Terror. It's just one of those things that makes me laugh hysterically.
I also loved her in Blue Hawaii. She plays Elvis's mother in Blue Hawaii.
And Barry Youngfellow, who again is not well remembered, she was in that syndicated sitcom It's a Living, which ran for like 10 years.
Oh, it was on forever, yeah.
And has that theme song that you cannot get out of your head. Look up on YouTube the theme song from It's a Living, and you will be cursing me and humming it for the rest of the month.
you mentioned the Queen, and like it wasn't a surprise because the Queen was, you know,
96,
old.
Yeah.
And I guess that was the same feeling with Vin Scully, because Vin Scully was old, but it just seemed like he would never leave us. And he, you know, it was really a.
I mean, even I've heard of him, and I don't know anything about sports people.
Well, he's one of the great voices in radio, regardless of whether you like sports or not.
And Howard Hessman, I always loved him. I always kind of got him confused with Martin Mull, but I like both of them. Martin Mull's
still alive and well, I believe.
Yeah, Martin Mull is still working.
Howard Hessman, he was with the that improvisational group, the Committee, I think they were called. Mm-hmm. And he was very funny before becoming a star on his own.
And Carlton Carpenter, from all those musicals in the 50s, worked with Debbie Reynolds several times, because Carlton Carpenter was like 7 feet tall and Debbie Reynolds was about, 4'8".
I hear from you regularly when people die. I get a little email from you. And you note even the most obscure people when...
If we have a photo of them in our collection, even if I've never heard of them, I sent out two Italian actors I'd never heard of just this morning, but we had great photos of them. So I did quick research on them, got a nice quote from one of them. I mean, I didn't get a quote from them. They were dead, but found a nice interview, and out they go. I'm on death duty 24/7.
When I was a kid, I used to enjoy Dr. Kildare, and there was a two-parter episode of Dr. Kildare. It was called Tiger, Tiger, in which Dr. Kildare fell in love with a surfer girl who had epilepsy, but she couldn't give up surfing because she loved it so much.
Is that the Yvette Mimieux one?
Yvette Mimieux. And so yes. I was saddened to hear of her death because I had such a crush on her in 1964.
My sister and I watched Where the Boys Are on TV when I was little, and I couldn't understand why Yvette Mimieux walked out crying in the rain after she got raped by I can't remember who. And my sister told me, I'll explain it to you when you're older. So every so often, my sister and I are now both quite elderly, and every so often I'll call her up and go, so why did Yvette Mimieux walk out in the rain? I'm not old enough yet. I can't tell you.
She was also...
Wait till you're 80.
She was also in The Time Machine. Mm-hmm. I liked her in that, where she was...
Where everybody in the future has bleached blonde hair.
Yes, that's right.
Did you ever notice, I think it's Beyond the Planet of the Apes, one of the earlier Planet of the Apes movies, yeah, where all the blonde monkeys wear June Allison wigs. It's like... I don't know if they had all of June Allison's old wigs in the storehouse and they decided to use them on the monkeys, but it's like a world where monkeys evolved from June Allison. And Andrew Prime died this year, and
yes,
which brings up the Karen Kupcinich case, because he was one of the prime suspects in her death. She was a charming actress. People only remember her for her mysterious unsolved death in 1963. And she had recently broken up with Andrew Prime. Mm. And it was never solved. Nobody ever knew what happened to her. And there's all kinds of insane conspiracy theories because she died the weekend of the Kennedy assassination. So of course it has to be connected with the Kennedy assassination, because nobody else could ever possibly die that weekend and it would just be a coincidence. But she was a charming actress. Old People TV also ran Mrs. G Goes to College, where she played one of the students. And she was an absolutely charming, delightful comic actress. And unfortunately, she's one of those people who's only remembered for her death.
That is sad. And it's nice of you to remind us that she did something else.
She was wonderful. She was also in a Perry Mason right before she died. And yeah, Judy Tyler was also in a Perry Mason right before she died. And I'm thinking, coincidence?
I was watching a Perry Mason recently, and Paul Drake is talking to Perry Mason on the phone, and he's at a train station. And a woman walks by carrying a suitcase, and it's my mother. My mother was an extra in movies. She's still alive and well.
So she survived her Perry Mason encounter.
Yeah, and when she walks by with that suitcase in her hand, that's acting.
You really believe... She actually didn't have a suitcase, but she made you believe that there was a suitcase there.
That's...
She's
right.
Such a good actress. My friend Marlon Mason was on the very last episode of that, and she said they were really nice. It was a very friendly set, but they were so cheap, they made her wear her own clothing.
Yeah, well, actually, my mom says they always had extras. She says, I had that. That was my coat when I showed her the scene from Perry Mason.
Yep. The Perry Mason people, you had to bring your own clothes.
Well, Eve Golden, we've only touched upon so many of the major deaths this year.
Leslie Jordan, William Hurt, there were so many.
There were. And James Caan, mm-hmm, Kirstie Alley, Sally Kellerman.
Yep.
Peter Bogdanovich, who had been a guest on my show here also.
Yeah. Ray Liotta. Michelle Nichols,
Tony Dow,
Michael Callan.
Yeah, a lot of great stars from the past and political people as well.
Gorbachev, yeah, and Madeleine Albright.
Ken Starr, I can't say that I was particularly sorry about Ken Starr.
I have to be very careful because I'm writing for my company and not for me. So when people I don't like die, I can slip a little Easter egg in for my friends and they will know what I'm saying. But for the general public, it's just a nice, bland little obituary.
Actually, didn't that happen with Tony Dow? I'm not that you didn't like him, but he died and then it turns out he wasn't dead. And then he died the next day. And you said he's not only
merely dead, he's dead, really most sincerely dead. And I did do that also when the actual mayor of Munchkinland died. that I pointed out that he really most sincerely died.
Well, Eve Golden, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Come back and talk to us again soon.
You too. Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our archive at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. And you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Deborah Holt Larkin. Her book is called A Lovely Girl, The Tragedy of Olga Duncan and the Trial of One of California's Most Notorious Killers, and our contributor Eve Golden for coming by this week. Happy holidays to all of you, and we'll see you soon. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf.